Welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. This is Jody White and welcome to Agri Business Innovation. Joining me today, Mr. Regis Chapman, Representative and Country Director for the World Food Programme Caribbean Multi-Country Office. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so as you mentioned, my name is Regis Chapman. I'm the World Food Programme, or WFP, representative and country director in our multi-country office for the Caribbean. So I'm based in Barbados, but we cover the 22 countries and territories of the English and speaking Dutch Caribbean.
Now, you told me you've been involved in this for quite a long time.
Yeah, I've been working in development and humanitarian issues since I graduated university. So over 25 years of experience at very grassroots level up to now working for the United Nations. So the World Food Programme is a United Nations agency.
So what exactly does the WFP do?
Good question. So I'm going to answer that in a couple of different ways. There's what WFP does globally and what we're probably more well known for. There's what we're doing in the Caribbean and what we're doing in here in Trinidad. So the World Food Programme is the world's largest humanitarian agency. We say saving lives and changing lives. And that's a really important nuance. You know, we're very well known around the world for our work in conflicts, complex disasters, and countries with failed states or governments that are really struggling to kind of do some of the work that, you know, governments in the Caribbean are able to do because of insecurity and poverty and other factors. But on the other side, we do a lot of work on the development side of the equation. And this is where that changing lives narrative comes in. So really what we do in the Caribbean is we work with government counterparts and we work with regional entities, CARICOM Secretariat or the Caribbean Disaster Emergency Management Agency, CEDEMA, helping to strengthen systems at the national and regional level to do what WFP would do in other contexts. So it's really a recognition of the strong systems that governments in the Caribbean have, but recognizing that as a global organization, the World Food Programme can bring certain expertise and experience and knowledge from around the world to help governments deal with some of the challenges that they face.
Now, on a personal level, what made you want to get involved with this?
I think on a personal level, like most things, you learn which way you want to go by going the way that you don't want to go. So you kind of come across things that you decide you like by sometimes making mistakes, right? And so maybe mistake is the wrong word. But I was in university studying marketing and business, and there were things about it that I liked and made me passionate. But yeah, for the most part, I think the more I went through it, the less I wanted to kind of graduate and go into a job that was aligned with my degree. And so I started taking other courses, political science and whatnot. And one day I was going to one of my political science courses and I saw a poster for the Peace Corps. So I'm originally from the United States. The United States Peace Corps is a volunteer program of the government. And I essentially, a couple nights later, went to a meeting, and about 5 minutes into it, I was grabbing an application. It just sounded perfect. Going to see different cultures and learn different languages and get out of your bubble that you grow up in. And so that led me to leaving the U.S. and going to a rural Salvadoran village, and it sort of changed my life.
Now, I saw that you worked in a lot of regions. Mm. Tell me a little bit about some of the pieces that you've been with this.
So with the World Food Programme, it's kind of been an evolution. I started off in the Peace Corps. When I was in the Peace Corps, I was impacted by a hurricane in 1998, Hurricane Mitch hit much of Central America. And so I saw the aftermath of that. And, you know, by default, I started helping. And that led to work with the Red Cross, which eventually led to work with the World Food Programme. And, you know, one of the things that led me to the World Food Program is I wanted to be able to take some of the work that I'd done at a grassroots level to scale, to look at national level, how we can influence what governments do, how you can reach more people and provide a greater level of assistance. And the other thing that was interesting to me was complex emergencies and conflicts. I grew up in a relatively stable, a very stable society and didn't have these exposure to these types of issues and working in, you know, responding to hurricanes and earthquakes and these things. I was interested to see how these more protracted crises work. And so I ended up switching over to the World Food Program. And I worked in Afghanistan for a couple of years, which was a rather different experience compared to, say, you know, the Caribbean, for example.
You know, in the Caribbean, we are susceptible to many things. Yeah. I mean, at the basis is climate change, but then there is political instability, the amount of hurricanes that we get. The problems in the Caribbean, though, are likely beyond that. What types of problems, then, do you see or risks do you see in the region?
So it's a really good question. And I think, you know, when you think about the Caribbean, you think about hurricanes, right? Now, sitting here in Trinidad, that's not really, for now, hopefully that doesn't change.
We say God is a trini, because every time a hurricane comes, it doesn't come.
God is a trini indeed. But it's still, there are these risks. And I think that sort of approach to things, you know, many people throughout the Caribbean, you spend, you know, half the year on a knife's edge wondering, is this my year? Is this my turn, right? And you know, we've seen the forecast for this hurricane season, quite a scary forecast, if you will. But it doesn't matter if there's, you know, it takes one storm on one day to hit one populated area that has certain vulnerabilities. And that can be an infrastructure, that can be social vulnerabilities, it can be a number of different things, right? And so if the forecast is what we would call a good forecast or it's a bad forecast, it matters, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't matter until a storm actually hits an affected population. But that said, it's not just hurricanes, right? I mean, we are very susceptible to seismic issues, you know, earthquakes. We've seen, I think just today I saw on a WhatsApp group that there was a small earthquake, 5-something, lower fives, felt in Antigua and Barbuda. But, you know, we saw the volcanic eruption in St. Vincent and the Grenadines in 2011. But there's also, I think, you know, again, when we look at Caribbean SIDS, yes, there's that climate vulnerability. I think what's different about a small island developing state or SIDS is the magnitude that these events have when they do hit. So, for example, 2017, Hurricane Maria hit Dominica. In one day, wiped out 220% of the country's gross domestic product, GDP. In one day, wiped out the economy times two, right? I mean, it's unfathomable. These same storms then move on and they go hit, say, southern Florida or perhaps Texas and go, you know, go through the Gulf. They hit a large country like the U.S. And obviously the impacts for the people that are hit by these hurricanes are, you know, comparable to what happens in any other country. But you have the entire country's economy that's, for the most part, been unimpacted by this, right? So that magnitude that you have on a small island as opposed to a larger, you know, geographic state is quite significant. I use the example of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. 20% of the population fled from the north of the island when the volcano began to erupt. 20%. I mean, it was only around 20,000 people. That doesn't sound like a lot. 20% is massive. Imagine 20% of Port of Spain having to get up and go.
Yeah, and you know what? I was there for a project a few years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and the stories of the farmers talking about when the ash came down, blanketed the crops, they lost everything, they couldn't access. There's a lab that was there that was set up. They couldn't get it. They tried to save equipment. Mm. So, you know, it is a lot. But you do more than just emergency situations. No. What about in places where things are going okay, but there is choices that the population makes that may not be in their best interest, that leads to malnutrition? No. So there is that work that you do as well there.
Yeah. So really, most of our work in the Caribbean is focused on supporting governments and providing technical assistance. So again, helping governments look at their disaster management systems and before an event happens, how can we strengthen them? Looking at social protection systems, how can you improve targeting or transparency or accountability of programs to ensure that the right people are being assisted with the right type of assistance. And this is a normal day-to-day, right? Looking at school meals programs or school nutrition programs, you know, how can we link smallholder farmers to those programs so that you have a livelihoods and an economic benefit that stays in the community with such programs, plus the importance of feeding kids, you know, that are struggling. And so a lot of our attention is really focused on that side of things. And then we maintain a readiness to respond when we have to. But really, you know, these vulnerabilities, as I mentioned, it's beyond climatic. It's beyond seismic. It's also so much is linked to that small size. So COVID-19, perfect example. COVID-19 affected everywhere, not just the Caribbean, not just Trinidad. But again, those impacts are magnified significantly in a smaller island state. You know, I was in Barbados at the time, and you know, the number of ICU beds, the number of ventilators, how are you going to be able to compete with large countries for vaccines or for masks or for any of the supplies that are needed? So it's this economy of scale thing. But the other side of it is supply chains. And in the Caribbean, one of the other big risk factors is the reliance on imported foods. And so not every country needs to be fully what we call food sovereign. In other words, produce all of their own food, right? Their trade is an important part of that, and that's okay. But the overwhelming reliance of many countries in the Caribbean creates an added vulnerability. So when supply chains start to shut down, if ships aren't moving, if goods aren't coming in, and you don't have that agricultural backbone that many other countries do, we saw this in COVID-19. And we also are susceptible in the Caribbean to high transport costs or fluctuations in transport costs. And so again, we saw this tail end of COVID-19, when the tail end of the severe parts of COVID-19 and all the lockdowns, when the war in Ukraine broke out. And that has led to significant increases in food prices, increases in the cost of everything that gets transported. And so when you're in an island, much of what we consume, food and otherwise, comes in by a vessel or by a plane. And when the cost of that go through the roof, well, you know, who pays for that? And so what we've been doing with the CARICOM Secretariat is since the very early days of COVID-19, we launched our first round of a food security and livelihood survey. We've completed just recently our seventh round, and the results will be announced in a couple of weeks. But if I go back to last year's round, we had estimated that around 52% of the population of the English-speaking Caribbean was food insecure. When you think of the Caribbean, you don't think of half the population as being food insecure. Now, there's different levels of food insecure, right? So we you know, highlight that overall 52%. I think it was around 7% that was 7 or 8% that was classified as severely food insecure.
But are some countries worse than some?
You know, so we do these surveys at a regional level. There are subsets of populations that we see that are worse than others. So, for example, here in Trinidad and Tobago, Spanish-speaking populations are particularly poor off compared to most of the rest of the region. That doesn't mean that Trinidad overall as a country had worse results, but certainly the Spanish-speaking segment. But there was no massive outlier from country to country that brought those numbers way up or way down. Again, it's just the English-speaking Caribbean that this data relates to. And so the preliminary results from the new survey, we see some slight improvements, but still, you know, much higher than we would expect. And so what is the cause of this? And again, we talked a little bit about agricultural production and the reliance on imports. But that affordability issue is really what we've seen at the heart of this. And so even if you produce, you know, all of the agricultural imports that are imported, the fertilizers, many fertilizers from around the world come out of Russia and Ukraine. So that war in Ukraine has impacted the flow, the cost, the supply availability, et cetera, of fertilizers, animal feed. You know, it's had repercussions on everything. So even if there was a much greater level of production in the Caribbean, there's still an affordability issue. And the erosion of livelihoods and therefore purchasing power that we've seen over the last several years since the start of COVID, you know, it's just these last few years have seen a significant increase in food insecurity. And this isn't just for, you know, the poorest segment of society. I see it going into the supermarket. I see how prices have changed over the last couple of years. I'm sure you have as well. And it's not just in the supermarkets, it's in restaurants. It's the price of everything has been going up. And so if salaries and income don't go up with that, you know, people were already dipping into their savings during COVID when you know, some of these supply chain disruptions took place.
So then we've spoken about so many things then. So what would you say would be some of the key objectives then that you would have right now?
So look, I think there's a few things. Look, you know, as I mentioned, the World Food Program, we largely provide technical assistance to governments and regional entities here. And part of that is advocacy, right? And so the purpose of these surveys that we've been doing is really to help put food security on the map. And we're seeing a lot more over the last couple of years, leaders, heads of state within the Caribbean talking about food security and food insecurity. It's risen on the agenda, and rightfully so, because we've seen the repercussions of relying so much on imports. So CARICOM has launched what they call the 25 by 25, yeah. Right? So you're familiar with that, reducing the import bill by 25% by the year 2025. And a lot needs to happen for that to take place. And so we're working with CARICOM and other partners and, of course, governments to see how we can address some of the bottlenecks that are impacting that. And again, there's issues around production. There's issues around transportation. There's issues around import and export. There's a slew of issues. And I think, you know, CARICOM and the Caribbean region as a whole, all the governments have been making strides in the right direction. And there's more that needs to be done. I don't think anyone would argue that. But a lot of progress is being made. And I can give a couple examples of very concrete things that the World Food Program is working on throughout the Caribbean. So a good example is in St. Vincent and the Grenadines again. So what we've seen, as I mentioned, social protection was important during COVID-19. Every government in the region, I would argue probably most governments in the world, used social protection type of programs to respond to the COVID crisis, right? We had people that were unable to go out, do their job, they weren't able to make money, there were more people that needed support from governments, right? So all governments increased, whether it was subsidizing electricity or providing targeted grants or whatever it might be, they did a number of things. Now, the problem was that I think when COVID started, none of us sat there and said, this is going to be a bit of a 2-year lockdown, right?
Everybody was thinking that it was just 4 weeks, 2 more weeks, 1 more week.
Exactly.
And it just extended to so long into like a perfect storm.
Exactly.
And what we found was that farmers were afraid to plant long-term crops because they didn't know if that situation would reoccur.
Yep.
So, you know, they got into short-term crops and then so many things then got lost. Yep. Planting material wasn't saved. They didn't have money to reinvest. And that just compounded some of the problems that we saw.
Yep. No, that's right. And I think what we're seeing now is a lot of governments that provided this social assistance or social protection support are now trying to figure out, well, what do we do? There's still people in need, but the budgets aren't there to continue to just, you know, spend at the levels that governments around the world did during COVID-19. And so more and more governments are looking at how can we provide livelihoods opportunities to vulnerable populations. So with the government of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, the World Food Program, they've launched what they call the We Can program. And it's really about transitioning people from social assistance or social welfare type programs to programs that provide training, provide, you know, some inputs, help get people on their feet and you know, into a more productive environment. I think similar to what's happening here in Trinidad and some of the programs targeting youth and agriculture that the government's launched in you know, recent months and years. And so a lot's happening, but it's a challenging set of problems. And I think, you know, you mentioned farmers not wanting to plant during those COVID eras or not wanting to plant long term. Again, some of the marketing environments around agricultural production in the Caribbean are really challenged. And many farmers, as a result, you know, there's a lot of part-time farming throughout the Caribbean, right? You can't necessarily just rely on that. And I, no pun intended, but it's a bit of the chicken and the egg and which came first, right? And you know, do you invest in building up this, you know, agricultural livelihoods, not being sure who you're going to sell to? And if you're a supplier, you're a supermarket, you're importing from outside of the country. If I can't rely on lettuces coming from you, you know, when do I take that leap? So it's
I've been seeing that for so long. There is a consistent mismatch of demand and supply. You know, a constant glut in the market followed by a major shortage. And it is just not sustainable in the model that we have. It is just a consistent mismatch, and that leads to prices fluctuating wildly. Now, one of the things that I have seen over the last number of years coming out of the UN and every organization is this word sustainability. And it is increasingly being used and incorporated into all these programs. So what is the importance of us considering sustainability in every effort that we make in this field?
I mean, it's critical in short. In long, I think, again, this is where the frameworks behind the 25 by 25 initiative, CARICOM, are really key. And I think where regional cooperation is paramount. You know, there are things that Trinidad does well, the manufacturing capacity. We have the rice production in Guyana and in Suriname. You know, you have each country kind of can bring different things together. So, you know, I look at, you know, having been a number of years in the Caribbean, regional integration. I've seen where it works in COVID-19 with the CARICOM trying to come together to pool those needs to have that economy of scale, to be able to get the masks and the ventilators and the vaccines, right? And I think we need to be brave around agriculture as well. We need to, one, modernize. There's a lot of people say, you know, we've got to make agricultural sexy again. This is sort of the buzzword that people talk about. And that links to the youth in agriculture. The agricultural population is aging, and you know, there's sort of a generational loss of people that aren't taking up agriculture anymore. They move to cities or there's other opportunities, you know, but we also see the impacts of rather singular economies. You know, many countries in the Caribbean rely primarily on tourism for employment. Well, what happens when you have a global pandemic and tourism stops? Right. And so I think agriculture, you know, we need to look at it through a whole of society approach. We need to look at the role not just that the Ministry of Agriculture plays, but ministries of social development, ministries of youth development, disaster management authorities, ministries of finance, right? Ministries of finance have a lot of tough decisions to make in the Caribbean about where to allocate resources and you know, when do you allocate for longer term investments at a shorter term, perhaps, cost, let's say, versus the short-term gains. And you know, governments around the world struggle with this, but I think the limited fiscal space that Caribbean governments have is quite a major challenge.
When we talk about youth and agriculture, and I speak to audiences, and the kids always look at me and expect me to say, go into a field and plant something. And I'm trying to tell them this field is beyond going into a field and digging the dirt or watering plants or driving a tractor. Engineering, biology, chemistry. There is so much that is involved in the field of agriculture that is necessary to support it and to grow it. And what I consistently see is that parents who are in the field don't want their kids to come into it because of the problems that they had. But the kids return educated with ideas of how to take this further, whether it is processing or proper contracts or different concepts of applying technology, you know? So do you see the Caribbean or the region as a whole, because I know you are beyond the Caribbean itself, do you see us applying modern techniques to some of these problems that we're facing? Are we starting to do that?
Most definitely. And so we've been working with the CARICOM Secretariat on a youth and agricultural campaign called I Am Agriculture. And every CARICOM state had an example of a young farmer who was doing innovative stuff, whether it was on the production side or the processing and marketing side. And there is a very vibrant youth in agricultural group out there throughout the Caribbean. I think one is about empowering them. Two is about how do we bring some of the technological advances and modernization of agriculture to larger numbers. And I think, you know, relying on digging a hole in the ground, dropping a few seeds and waiting for the rain, you know, there's always a degree of that. But the more that the sector can be modernized, the better. But it's not just the production and productivity side. It's also transport. And this is a really important one. If you don't have a solid transport network, and I'm talking about even within an island, right, where you can safely get your commodities from the field to a market, you know, if you're having significant losses along that chain, you've got a problem there. And so if you are growing watermelon and you throw all your watermelon in the back of a pickup truck and drive however many kilometers to a market over a bumpy farm road, you know, you have watermelon juice at the bottom and you know, watermelons are damaged and bruised. And, you know, I think you asked before about nutrition and maybe just to quickly transition to aspects about that, there's the behaviors of us as humans is another aspect in this, right? We see that watermelon that's a bit bruised and we don't want it. We want the other one, right? So that the losses along the way, but also the behavioral side on what we consume. And so it's not just the youth in agriculture and it's not just innovation. It's also about, you know, the whole motto of grow what you eat what you grow. And backyard farming, we saw huge increases of backyard farming, backyard chicken rearing and all of these sorts of things during the COVID-19 pandemic when we were all locked down and didn't have a whole lot better to do and trying to figure out
trying to plant something.
Exactly.
Yeah? So then would you say then our culture is part of the challenges that we're facing?
It's a huge challenge. And this isn't, again, unique to Trinidad. It's not unique to the Caribbean. As economies develop, a few things happen, right? One, we're busy people now, right? And we look for easy, quick food. And that easy, quick food isn't always the healthiest. But it's designed to taste good. It's designed to get us coming back for more as well. And so I think over time, society sort of lose a bit of that rich cultural history that we have through cuisine. You know, WFP has been working with CARICOM and other partners on a return to your roots campaign. And we mean roots literally, right? Your root crops. How do we get back to, and every country is different, right? But the importance of things like cassava and yam, as well as your rice and other production. Again, each country is different, but food is such an important part of culture. And you look at countries that have acknowledged that and built on it. Peru is a great example in Latin America. You know, Peru wasn't really known for having good food and for many years, but somewhere along the line, they realized, well, there actually is a lot of good cuisine here. And actually, if we market this right and we get it out there, and now people travel from all over the world to Peru to eat that local cuisine. So I think there is an aspect of behavioral change that we need to look at. And this goes to starting back with kids again. I mentioned before school meals programs or school nutrition programs. You know, we need those types of environments to start. One, you know, reminding kids of healthy diets, what's important, what's, you know, what might taste good 1 minute is not necessarily a healthy thing. And we need to look at the school environments and the circle around those environments and the circle around those environments. And this is where the role of parents come in as well. And so we need those messages to be reinforced by parents. We were talking with people today about school nutrition programs. And, you know, Yeah, I mean, we all want that quick, easy thing. But you know, I think the way that food prices have been increasing, you'll find that the fast food options aren't as cheap as they used to be. And actually, some of the you know, foods that your grandparents would have eaten are maybe not as expensive vis-a-vis that fast food anymore.
Listen, when I was in school, right, and kids would bring okra mm-hmm. and these things, kids would feel ashamed because they would feel as if I'm bringing poor people food. Mm. And it came to a point where incomes were growing in Trinidad and people would aspire to buy burgers and fries and pizza. That is what they're aspiring to do. And what happened in my high school now is that the kids started becoming excited to exercise and go to the gym. And whereas in my time, people used to break school to go to the arcade, they're breaking school to go to the gym. And they're starting to learn about healthy eating and they want to bring those foods to school because they are understanding nutrition and what it does for them. Mm. So we are seeing that sort of change happening. And getting back to the point where you're saying transport, listen, I have a company locally and we process a lot of cassava, right? It is cheaper for me to export to the US than to Barbados. Mm. I could send a container to the US easier, less bureaucracy, cheaper, and faster than I could send a container to Barbados. Because to get to Barbados, I'd have to ship it to maybe Jamaica and then send it back down to Miami and then send it back down. And then we would have consumed maybe about 30,000 pounds of cassava a month. And with the pandemic, right after came bad weather in Trinidad. We couldn't get raw materials. Guyana had some. I could not get it from Guyana to Trinidad. So we are an island, and literally we are not connected to everywhere else.
No. Yep. So I think I made the point on regional integration, and I think transport is a major issue within CARICOM countries. Aviation and maritime. I think much of the maritime industry is designed exactly as you highlight, right? It's you have feeder ports that aren't necessarily the port that, you know, you would be closest or that you would want to send to or trade with. It's out of Miami or it's out of Southern Florida or perhaps a Jamaica or a Bahamas where you have larger container ports, or it's a Panama or a Colombia, right? But yeah, inter-region trade is significantly constrained by transport. And this is an issue that, we saw it with Liat Airlines during, I live in Barbados. Liat was quite an important airline. And some others have stepped up to try to fill some of that void. But I can tell you, getting around now without Liat is a lot more complicated than pre-COVID. But the shipping one is really an important one. So I highlighted, the on-island kind of challenges with road transport in some countries, but certainly that intra-regional trade. This is part of the CARICOM 25 by 25 agenda as well. I've seen that there are some options of ferries, at least between a few of the countries moving forward. I've seen that, the government of Barbados is talking about creating a food terminal, which would help with, supply coming in and going out. Yeah, but we need the vessels and we need the shipping industry to make certain adaptations to facilitate that type of trade.
So then do you have any specific programs that you could mention that maybe you work with local agriculture and economies in the region?
Yeah. So, I mentioned the program in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Perhaps another example would be in Belize. So Hurricane Lisa hit in late 2022. And so we worked with the government. We provided some support to people immediately after the impact who were affected by that hurricane. But shortly thereafter, we realized that people who you wouldn't traditionally support were also struggling, farmers and smallholder farmers. And so we launched with the Ministry of Agriculture and Food Security in Belize a program that provided both cash transfers to meet basic household needs, but also a voucher support where they could redeem that at agricultural shops for inputs, agricultural inputs, seeds, fertilizers, tools, et cetera, to get those livelihoods back up and running. And so that's in the more emergency type context. But we're also working with governments throughout the region on school meals programs. And in particular, how do we link school meals programs, that institutional purchasing mechanism, with smallholder farmers. So again, as I mentioned, we see this as sort of a dual impact. One, we ensure healthy, nutritious food at the school for school children. But two, the it's more of a circular economy. The resources, the money that's going to purchase that food is staying local as opposed to going out.
You know, there was a move to stop schools from using sodas in school meals, and they substituted the sodas with water. And they got calls from parents saying that you're feeding my kids prison food, giving them water with the meals. And there is a gap in education and awareness that we consistently see. Are there programs that you have in place that focus on education?
So working with some governments around the region, I mean, this is not a unique thing to Trinidad. Let me start by saying that. But this is where that education needs to be twofold. It needs to be towards the students, but it also needs to involve the parents, right? And so WFP around the world does a lot of work around social behavioral change communication. And so what that effectively means is working with stakeholders, designing messages to help to slowly change some of those behaviors, right? And what you're trying to do is substitute some of the bad behaviors with good behaviors. But you can't just necessarily, do a move one thing out and throw another thing in and expect that, that change is just accepted. You need to create the value, right? You need to create the value in that water. Why is water better than soda? My kids are in school, young kids, and one of them came back from an experiment that they did where they, measured how many grams of sugar are in different drinks and different products. And they weighed that amount of sugar out and poured it in a cup. And so you look at a cup of a fizzy soda drink and you see that, it's like half full of sugar. And then the next one is a artificial juice and it's a third full of sugar, whatever the quantities are. But I think it's, part of it is creating that message at a younger age. And there, it's not to say that you can never have another unhealthy drink or you can never eat at a fast food restaurant again, but it's about balance, right? And I think that's part of those educational messages. It's not, no, you can never have fast food again, or no, you can never have a soda again. But really, how do you understand moderation and what is a healthy diet? And people make then conscious choices about what they eat, right? Rather than habitual choices or just relying on what we like. Because the NCDs are a major issue in the Caribbean, right?
We have the third fattest population in the entire world here. We have the fifth highest rate of diabetes in the entire world. Most of our population dies of an NCD.
Well, so I think this is where, this as countries develop, as I mentioned before, our behaviors begin to change. And this is where those tough economic decisions that governments have to make, I think what we need to do, and this is, again, some of the advocacy work that we do as the World Food Program and other UN agencies do, is to really, showcase the economic impacts of certain things. And so, we've, as WFP, we've worked with ECLEC, the UN's Economic Commission for mm-hmm. Latin America and the Caribbean, mm-hmm. and a number of Latin American countries, where we conducted a series of studies that were called the cost of the double burden. And what this looked at is, so the cost of undernutrition is sort of going down in terms of the cost on society as a whole, right? So the loss of productivity that undernutrition has on a number of countries is going down. But the cost of obesity, overweight, overnutrition is dwarfing that. So again, the cost of dealing with diabetes, dealing with the cancers, dealing with all of these issues that have come out of these lifestyle changes that developing economies have is so significant that it's worth spending those investments now. And these are tough things to do, right? You need to, but at some point I think we need to be bold and begin to make some of these changes and look at how policies, facilitate a healthier diet for young kids at school and throughout society, how, education complements that. And these things aren't solved overnight, but we need to start and we need to start somewhere. And you can't just kick the can down the road forever, right?
I remember the first time I went to Denver, every other car had a bicycle rack on the top. And it said to me that there's a difference in the culture here versus the culture in Trinidad, because when I grew up, there were cycling groups. We'd get together every weekend, we'd go around the country, huge groups, sometimes rides with 500 small bicycles. And those are things that we've stopped seeing. We've stopped seeing kids going out on an afternoon and playing football and playing cricket. We've really seen a shift away from that. And I'm not sure what is going to happen to start to push people back into the direction of physical activity and becoming healthier. So I know you do a lot of collaboration with governments. My question is, how much resistance is there to change when you're trying to collaborate or partner with local organizations?
I actually don't see much resistance to change. I find our work in the Caribbean has been really quite amazing. So, I think, again, a lot of challenges in the Caribbean, it goes to that economy of scales. I look at governments that we work with throughout the Caribbean, and, you've got, very bright people, motivated people within governments. I think the challenges, again, is there's a couple. So one, it's a limited fiscal space. So all of those economic dynamics, singular economies, reliance on imports, all of these things creates very limited fiscal space. Two, the global finance systems that we have in the development world, in a way, penalize certain countries. So if you graduate to a classification that is referred to as middle income, or in the case of other countries like Trinidad, high income, your ability to access certain types of funds reduces, right? And so what we often see is basically stalling of development indicators. Right. So, as you're a developing country and you're getting resources, you're getting support and you're developing your systems, there's a lot more external support that comes in. But then you hit a certain economic point at the macro level and you're told, right, you've arrived and now you're on your own effectively. Right. And I'm paraphrasing quite significantly here and simplifying it a bit. But I think in what you see in countries around the world is this then stall in all of your development indicators. And we've seen it in the Caribbean. Economic growth, if you take out Guyana with the oil and gas industry right now, economic growth had been, even before COVID, had been relatively low vis-a-vis many other countries. You have less and less resources that governments can allocate to those things that make long-term change: education, health, right? Protecting the most vulnerable of our societies. And then on top of this, not having that fiscal space, you then have the existential threat of climate change and other shocks that occur that, as I mentioned before, have such a higher magnitude of impact compared to a larger state, right? So you have this vulnerability coupled with this sort of lack of fiscal space. Now, there's a lot of effort, and the Caribbean has a very important voice on this, and you may or may not know, but every 10 years, there's a global conference on small island developing states. And in 2 weeks' time, if I have my dates right, 3 weeks' time, is the fourth global conference, Global SIDS conference, being held in Antigua and Barbuda. And this is where the Caribbean can come together and really, raise its voice as one. And this is where that regional integration is quite important. Again, it's getting that economy of scale by speaking as one. The Caribbean has a lot of important voices in the region and a lot to say and a lot to show the world. Disaster management is a really good one. Much of disaster management around the world is modeled off of examples from the Caribbean, right? The Caribbean has a lot to offer. Bright people, dedicated people, innovation happening, but with so many constraints that it makes advancements in certain ways a challenge. So in our work with governments, we haven't had a whole lot of resistance. You know, we have challenges, right? I mean, governments have a lot on their plate. And so, you know, sometimes not being able to get enough time and energy to move something forward, you know, but that's because they're, again, small governments trying to deal with big problems. What we have seen is that some of the innovative work that we're able to bring to the table helps governments to think a little bit outside of the box and say, ah, okay, that worked for that smaller program. Let's expand that now. And so I mentioned the example of Belize and the work that we did with the Ministry of Agriculture. Those transfers were made through a mobile money setup. First example, there's no mobile money anywhere else in the Caribbean, really, in the English-speaking Caribbean. There's apps, right? There's apps that you can transfer money, but through a mobile service provider, there's no sort of money transfer mechanisms. Belize has this, and they've been using it for more and more of their government transfers, right? And so that digital solutions to provide support from the government to populations creates huge efficiency gains, right? And so many governments are looking at how they can digitalize some of these processes. And some of it, sometimes it's just WFP is able to provide a helping hand and say, hey, here's our experience from around the world of digital cash transfers, or here's our experience in communicating to vulnerable populations when we see a hurricane coming, or here's some of, and so it's really trying to bring some of that expertise in a way that's, that helps government make some of these advances. And I think what's interesting is so the World Food Program, as I said at the beginning, we're very well known for our work in emergencies or in more conflict type settings, large scale emergencies, protracted conflicts, these sort of things. Whereas WFP, we have to do a lot of the work, right? We distribute the food, we target the populations, we conduct the assessments. Here you have governments that do and are able to do the vast majority of that. And so again, it allows us to sort of retweak what we do, but we very much bring that field perspective, that community perspective to our work and really work hand in hand with governments. So it's not that they need someone else to give them a good idea. They have the ideas. They don't have the breathing room to implement sometimes. And so what we try to do is work with our counterpart ministries to create a little bit of that extra space and help them roll out their good ideas. And you know, we throw in some of our international and global experience.
So I'm hearing you have immediate, short-term, medium-term, and long-term activities that are happening, from disasters to changing or educating with cultures and so on. How is this funded?
So the World Food Program is a 100% voluntarily funded organization. So all of our resources that allow us to do the work that we do in the Caribbean, we mobilize through partnerships with development partners. So, you know, we receive resources from the United States Agency for International Development and the Bureau of Humanitarian Affairs, from Global Affairs Canada, from the EU. Within the UN system, there's these things called the SDG Fund, the Sustainable Development Goal Fund. And so this is more pooled funding where we work with other agencies, private sector organizations and entities. I'm probably missing a couple that I should mention. But really, so it's about partnerships. And so again, WFP has capacities that we can bring, and then other actors have resources, and it's, you know, that kind of chain of a donor to a World Food Program, and we work closely with that donor, but then we're also the hand-to-hand engagement on the day-to-day basis with government counterparts.
So for our listeners who want to learn more about the activities that are happening in the region, learn about the programs that are there, maybe some of the research that is coming out. How can they learn more about this?
So WFP.org/Caribbean is our public website, and the link to the Caribbean Multi-Country Office and some of our work can be found there. We have a 5-year multi-country strategic plan that outlines the work that we're doing throughout the Caribbean, throughout the English-speaking Caribbean. And that program is aligned with the broader United Nations framework for the Caribbean. And then here in Trinidad, we have an office here in Trinidad. We engage with partners locally as well. And
I would say that over the last year or so, as I would have attended different functions related to food and nutrition, I've seen the WFP's presence here in everything, because I guess everything is connected. So I've clearly been seeing that there is a level of support that is happening, I would say, in the background, because I know some of the listeners may not know how much is actually being done. So it's nice to see that there is that level of support, and there is that level of change, and there is that level of development. Now, is there anything else, because we're kind of running out of time, is there anything else that you'd like to bring up to the listeners about the work that you're doing, maybe about a drive that is coming up that you would like people to get involved in? Is there anything you want to mention again?
Sure. So maybe just to address the point about, not being so well known and being a bit in the background, we do that by design. And again, I highlighted the role of governments here in the Caribbean, and we view those governments as the frontline, providers of these types of programs. And so we actually take a bit of pride of being a little bit hidden in the background. On May 21st, we're launching the results of the 7th round of the food security and CARICOM food security and livelihoods survey, along with the CARICOM secretariat. And so I think that's one thing to keep your eyes open for. And then also at the Global SIDS conference that I mentioned, we have a number of events taking place there to really highlight some of the challenges around food security and SIDS. And I think, one side, obviously, being from a small island developing states, your listeners, they live it. It's the reality, right? I think for us, the importance of that conference is to help lend our voice as a global, UN agency to the uniqueness of SIDS and some of the unique development challenges that you have, to really help to try to, to add our voice for change and how things work sometimes and make it easier for governments in the Caribbean to make some of the developments that they need to.
I think you've given us a lot of insight into this background work that is being done. And it's nice to know that there is that level of support for development that is taking place, because it is really, really, really needed if we are going to sustainably improve our lives in the Caribbean. Food and nutrition is the backbone of the economy. So that is good. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We have run out of time. Today's discussion was with Mr. Regis Chapman from the WFP. Thank you so much again for joining us. And I do hope that you come back and visit us soon. I know definitely we'll be in contact with the Trinidad office as we move forward to keep abreast of things and maybe showcase work and results as it is evolving and happening.
WFP.org/Caribbean, and we can also be followed on social media, Twitter at WFP Caribbean, and also a Facebook page. So if you're in the Caribbean and look for the World Food Program on Facebook, you should see the work we're doing here in the Caribbean.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. This brings us to the end of the show. Tune in next week again for another installment. Take care.